Hello, today is Thursday, April 9th, 2026. Following is a 30-minute reading coming to you from the Talking Information Center featuring the latest edition of Sports Illustrated. My name is Fred. Scorecard, essay, Hall Justice. The process of determining who gets enshrined in Canton is flawed. Here's how to fix it. One man's opinion, anyway. This is by Michael Rosenberg. Bill Belichick obviously should not have to wait to get into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But at least he has company, like the six-time Super Bowl-winning head coach Bill Walsh, was not elected on the first ballot. Bill Parcells waited 4 years. But the problem goes far beyond coaches who should have sailed in. The entire selection process is a delay of game penalty. Michael Strahan and Michael Irvin both had to wait. The last time a center was elected on the first ballot was 1987. No tight end made it in the first year until 2019. When the NFL released its 100th anniversary all-time team in 2019, Alan Page, Mike Haynes, Dick Night Train Lane, and John Mackey were all unanimous selections to the 100-player roster. None of them were elected to the Hall of Fame on the first ballot. Many other players on that all-time team should not have had to wait, but did anyway. Voters take the job seriously, but they are hamstrung by a system that limits the number of inductees per year and places everybody except modern-era players, a pool that has its own restrictions, and in the same bucket. Former coaches like Belichick are judged alongside both contributors like his old boss Robert Kraft and players from the pool of senior candidates. Voters could only select three from that grouping, so they were forced to choose between Belichick and other deserving candidates who have waited much longer. Belichick will clearly get in eventually, but for others, this might have been their last shot. That process needs to be fixed, but the whole process needs to be fixed. Each year, modern-era player finalists are put on the ballot regardless of position. Each class of inductees is capped at five players. It's simplistic and silly. For an entity that exists to celebrate pro football, the Hall of Fame shows remarkably little understanding of it. Pro football is a highly specialized sport. Lumping everybody together regardless of position is preposterous. This is not how recognition works in any other aspect of the sport. Imagine if the all-pro team consisted of the 30 best players regardless of position. The NBA's maximum salary system is the same for point guards and centers because both can be cornerstones. That would never work in the NFL. Nobody would ever claim that the best left guard is worth as much as the best quarterback. That is why the NFL's franchise tag is determined by the value of the highest salaries at each position. Pro Football Hall of Fame voters are forced to begin the process from an illogical place. They have to spread the votes around the field. And that's the problem, because five votes per class is not enough. Or let me add, or maybe they're just putting too many people in. The last 10 years elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame played on average 18 big league seasons. NFL players rarely come close to that. Even guys who seem to play for a long time clock out relatively early. Hall of Famers Joe Thomas and Darrell Revis each played 11 seasons. Ed Reed played 12. Calvin Johnson only played 9. Pro Football Hall of Fame voters have embraced players with high peaks but short careers. Tony Boselli started 90 games. Terrell Davis had four fantastic seasons. got injured and only played 17 more games. I'm not going to debate their candidacies here, but their election served to strengthen the case for other players with similar career arcs. This is all compounded by the fact that football also has more positions than baseball. Every NFL team has 11 starters on offense and 11 on defense, plus a kicker, punter, and returners. That means there are 25 positions that should have at least some representation in the Hall of Fame. Not equal representation, some representation. Baseball teams have 11 positions that deserve some representation. 9 everyday players, including designated hitter, starting pitcher and reliever. Now, pitchers obviously don't pitch in every game. And some teams employ multiple pitchers who are performing at a Hall of Fame level. But football teams still have many more positions that should be represented in the Hall of Fame. It makes sense for the Baseball Hall of Fame to place all players in the same pool. One can reasonably weigh the relative value of a second baseman and a center fielder. Comparing a right tackle to a cornerback is a lot harder. And comparing any quarterback to a non-quarterback is harder still. But the Hall of Fame asked voters to do it anyway. So, rather than simply vote for the most dominant players at each position in each era, Pro Football Hall of Fame voters have to manage the line, one receiver at a time. This guy will obviously get in, but we have 5 ahead of him. Oops, we ignored this position entirely for a few years. Gotta rectify that. This is how ridiculous it gets. When Chris Carter retired, he was number 2 all-time in receptions and receiving touchdowns, and 3rd in receiving yards. He was not elected to the Hall of Fame until his 6th year of eligibility. James Lofton retired as the NFL's all-time leader in receiving yards. When he became eligible for the Hall in 1999, he was not even a finalist. He was elected on his 5th ballot. There can be some reasons a Hall of Famer does not get in on the first ballot. Some cases are stronger than others. Sometimes voters need time and context to come around. Sometimes the delay is a small punishment for an ethical or moral transgression. But those cases are pretty rare. Mostly players wait because the process is built to make them wait. From 2006 to 2020, there were 94 modern-era player finalists. Of those, 79 eventually made the Hall of Fame one way or another. What is the point of winnowing the list, winnowing it down, if almost everybody on it will get elected eventually anyway? Weights are not even the main problem. They are a symptom of a larger system failure. When obvious Hall of Famers like Strawn and Thurman Thomas have to go through the process multiple times, that means that less obvious but still deserving candidates never even receive proper consideration. Kicker Adam Vinatieri was one of 2 kickers on the 100th anniversary team, but when he became eligible for the Hall last year, he was not elected. Vinatieri was a finalist, which is more than we can say for former Raiders punter Shane Leckler. Leckler made the 100th anniversary team and 2 all-decade teams. He was a first-time all-pro 6 times. He became eligible for the Hall of Fame in 2023 and has never even been a semifinalist. In terms of overall value to a team, Vinatieri, who got in earlier this year on his 2nd try, and Leckler will be among the 5 best candidates on a ballot. But Devin Hester wasn't either. Hester was elected in 2024 ahead of 6-time All-Pro Antonio Gates, among others, because he was probably the best kick returner ever. It is time for the Hall of Fame voting process to reflect the game itself. Like this. Separate ballots by position group. Let's make comparisons reasonable and group candidates like this. Quarterback, offensive line, offensive skill positions, defense, and special teams. This way, everybody has a path to the Hall. And Vinatieri does not have to compete against Drew Brees in the first place. Next, clear-cut finalist guidelines. Advance the following players to finalist. One quarterback, one offensive lineman, two offensive skill players, four defensive players, one special teamer, and three other players, regardless of position. That way, Brees and Eli Manning can both advance, or the Hall could finally address its glut of receiver candidates. Next, no more five-vote limits. For each finalist, allow voters to choose yay or nay. Trust them to take it seriously because they already do. Next, and lastly, put coaches and contributors in their own categories and remain flexible. Give voters some leeway there. That goes for the entire architecture of laid out here. Adjust the system as warranted over time. If voters start electing mediocre special teamers, that can be addressed. Look, this is just one possible solution. It's not the only one, and it might not be the best one, but it would make a lot more sense than what the Hall does now. Scorecard. Game plan. Jacket book. One half of Men in Blazers is back with a series of World Cup reminiscences. This piece is by Mark Betchell. With his thick Scouse accent, his deep love of Everton, and a wry sense of humor, Roger Bennett seems quite the Englishman. His Wikipedia page notes, without citation, but not without believability, that he is fond of tweed. Tweed with a T. In reality, though, Bennett has been in the United States for more than 30 years, which provided the narrative thrust of first memoir regarding Born in the USA. His new book, entitled We Are the World Cup, is built around his memories of each tournament, beginning with the 1978 edition. It's a potentially dicey conceit, a book that relies heavily on 4+ decades of personal memories of watching sports, mostly on TV, can veer into this again territory pretty quickly. But Bennett pulls it off with ease for a few reasons. Most significantly, he's as funny and observant on the page as he is on TV and podcasts as part of Men in Blazers. And the book is more than Remember When. It traces the evolution of soccer in the U.S. from niche sport to something bigger. That's a theme that's been tackled many times before, but really by someone with Bennett's background and credentials. An already footy-mad Brit surrounded by indifferent Yanks. His chapter on the 1994 World Cup is especially entertaining. The opening ceremony held in Chicago, where Bennett happened to be living as a broke 23-year-old, featured Diana Ross scuffing a shot at a wide-open net in a show that also featured the likes of Daryl Hall and John Cicada, with Oprah Winfrey as the MC. A clumsy piece of footballing choreographed gone wrong amidst glamour and glitz, which felt like a cruel metaphor for all that was supposed to come, he writes. Indeed, the sport didn't catch immediately. Bennett moved to Washington, D.C., where he describes watching games in bars with small crowds of expats, including a mysterious diplomat who never removed the briefcase chained to his wrist, even as he ate with one hand and drank a pint with the other. Later chapters touch on the author's perspective as part of the MIB, the groundwork for which was laid on the day of the 2006 final, when he met his co-host Michael Davies as they commiserated over missing the game-deciding penalty shootout because they had been dragged to the same wedding on a boat circling Manhattan. The cup, Bennett sweetly notes, might just change your life. Okay. Scorecard Newsmakers headliner. The new head of baseball's players' union is not the type to back down. This piece is by Tom Verducci. Back in March 2024, Bruce Meyer, who was then the MLB Players Association Deputy Executive Director, survived a palace coup. His defense strategy included a letter to players in which he left certain the hawkish reputation he earned in his long career in labor negotiations. 2 years after a 99-day lockout ended in spring training of 2022, with an agreement between owners and players on a collective bargaining agreement, Meyer wrote that he sided with those players who had preferred shutting down the game rather than taking that deal. Some players emerged from the bargaining disappointed that we did not accomplish more, and in particular, that we did not miss games to see if more gains could be made, Meyer's letter read. To be clear, I sympathized and still do with these players in this position. Before coming to the MLBPA from the NHL Players Association, Meyer, who notably walked the picket line in solidarity with the striking members of the Writers Guild of America in 2023, had a distinguished career in sports labor law. That one paragraph best defines his approach. Even though 2 years had passed, he preferred missing games to see if more could be won at the table. On February 18th, Meyer was named interim executive director of the MLBPA after the stunning resignation of Tony Clark. That he emerged more powerful than ever from the 2024 opposition is a testament to his experience and tenacity. Given Meyer's hindsight on the 2022 deal, not to mention his history with other leagues, one agent summed the change from Clark to Meyer this way: the owners aren't happy. Philosophically, nothing changes at the MLBPA bargaining table. Meyer has been its lead negotiator and will continue as such. The MLBPA maintains a deeply rooted opposition to a salary cap. But two areas bear watching when it comes to possible differences with Meyer replacing Clark. The first is style. The second is strategy. Meyer's elevation is the equivalent of a football defensive coordinator becoming head coach. The decision tree just grew scores of branches, such as, to borrow from the 2022 settlement, when to punt and when to go for it. It also places a greater responsibility on leadership and communication skills. A union leader is a political leader, a kind of Speaker of the House. Solidarity is the backbone of union strength. The director is charged with creating a universally supported consensus. Clark, while not necessarily dynamic, had the inherent advantage of being a former major league player. He spoke the players' language, knew their successes, and felt their pain. Meyer, more direct of manner, is a labor negotiator who never had to worry much about the soft skills of leadership, which was apparent in 2024 when some players and agents wanted him out. They wanted Clark to replace him with Harry Marino, a young lawyer and former minor league pitcher, who brought minor leaguers under the union umbrella. Starting with his tour of camps this spring, Meyer had a chance to show players he has the chops to lead, not just digging his heels at the bargaining table. Building a universally supported consensus becomes more delicate as financial gaps widen among players, just as they do among teams. About 60% of players are paid at or near minimum salary. Minor league reps hold 47% of the votes of the 72-member executive board. The average big league career is less than the 6 years of service required for free agency. One in five rookies never make it back for a second season. A change in strategy from Clark to Meyer will not be clearly evident until we get closer to December 1, when the current CBA expires. Meyer has said owners likely will follow that expiration with a lockout, as was the case in 2021. It ended March 10, 2022, leaving barely enough time to avoid losing games. That season began a week later than scheduled and ended 3 days later, with the first week of scheduled games sprinkled throughout the year. The eight players on the executive subcommittee then felt as Meyer did about the last-ditch offer. Excuse me. They voted 8-0 against accepting the deal. It stood as a recommendation to the union at large to reject it. But after team representatives met with the teammates about the proposal, the players repudiated leadership and voted 26-4 to accept it. The only teams that rejected it, the Yankees, the Mets, the Astros, and the Cardinals, had a player on the subcommittee. Commissioner Rob Manfred was pragmatic in explaining why it took so long to get an agreement. Quote, time and economic leverage. No agreement comes together before those two things play out, he said, end quote. Most players do not wish to risk losing paychecks to try for more bargaining gains, such as greater bumps in the luxury tax thresholds. What could be different about the same scenario with Meyer as opposed to Clark wearing the headset and calling the plays? One agent said he expects Meyer to be more like Marvin Miller and Donald Fair, past executive directors who held the union together by concentrating influence on the front lines of bargaining, the negotiating team, and the subcommittee. Meyer's job as a lead negotiator hasn't changed, but as executive director, he has the added responsibility of building and holding consensus from about 6,700 members of the rank and file. Okay, moving to the history section of the scorecard. You using that? There's a long tradition of athletes in secondhand gear. This piece is by Mark Betchell. During a casual round of golf earlier this winter, Colin Morikawa borrowed a putter from one of his playing partners, Daniel Kitayama. I said, oh, let me try it, said Morikawa. I tried it on maybe the 13th hole. Hole, felt great, jokingly said, I might have to take this. He wasn't kidding. Morikawa kept the putter and practiced with it extensively. He used the club at the Phoenix Open and finished 54th. The following week at Pebble Beach, Morikawa used the TaylorMade Spider Tour X putter again and won for the first time on tour since October 2023. It's mine now, Morikawa declared after the win. This was just the latest in a long line of athletes, notably borrowing someone else's gear and often finding success. In 1912, Jim Thorpe, prior to the 1,500-meter race in the decathlon at the Summer Olympics in Stockholm, Thorpe's shoes were stolen. A teammate loaned him one where the other was remains a mystery, and he found another in a trash can. The one from the bin was too big, so Thorpe wore extra socks to make it fit better and won the race by nearly 2 seconds to clinch his second gold medal of the games. 1978, Bucky Dent. It's a well-worn story. Dent's famous homer against the Red Sox in the American League East playoff was a hit with a bat belonging to teammate Mickey Rivers. But there's more to it than that. Rivers had originally borrowed the bat from outfielder Roy White, who was on first when Dent homered. He got there on a single. He hit using a bat he borrowed from infielder Fred Stanley. 1994, Darryl Johnson, after Dallas won the Super Bowl 10-28 in Atlanta, the gear belonging to the team's Pro Bowlers was shipped to Honolulu. One problem, the helmets were pilfered. The Cowboys fullback improvised, borrowing an extra from Packers quarterback Brett Favre. I had to pump in so much air in Favre's hat, I thought my head was going to float off, Johnson said after the NFC's win. 2010, Bobby Ryan, late in the second period of a game against Anaheim, Mikko Koivu of the Wild lost his stick, so he forcibly borrowed one being used by Ducks forward Ryan. When he realized he wasn't getting his stick back, Ryan picked up Koivu's and promptly scored with it. Said Ryan, "I just told him, you took mine, so finders keepers, I guess." 2015-2016, Kobe Bryant. Then there's the opposite of borrowing. Late in his career, as the Lakers were in the midst of a 65-loss season, the Black Mamba got fed up with the effort of his team's younger players. After a blowout loss, he sent an equipment man into the locker room with a garbage can to repo the shoes of any player, with the exception of a few veterans, wearing Kobe's Nikes. 2018, Ester Ledecka. The snowboarder surprised no one, winning the parallel giant slalom gold at the Pyeongchang Olympics. She surprised everyone, however, herself included, by winning the Super G. Ledecka was so lightly regarded in alpine events that she didn't even have skis. She borrowed a pair from Michaela Schifrin. Until today, she said, "I thought I was a better snowboarder." And then lastly, 2021, Daniel Camarena. The Padres called up the reliever from AAA El Paso on July 8th. Since the minors use a DH, he didn't have a batter or batting gloves. So Gosuke Kato of the Chihuahuas loaned him some gear. Which Camarena used to hit a grand slam off of Max Scherzer. He then called Catch to ask for another bat. Not because he wanted more, said Catcher, because they put that bat in the Padres Hall of Fame. Well, there you have it. That's going to conclude our reading on this ninth day of the fourth month in the year 2026. Been a pleasure reading to you from the Talking Information Center. I hope you've enjoyed listening. And better still, I hope you have a wonderful day. Please do take care. My name is Fred.